Last time we looked at the lives of several characters from the Bible, and our topic, of course, is finding God's will. And what we've been doing is looking at how God leads certain individuals in the Bible, and we're taking from the lessons that we learned there, and we're applying that to the notion of how to find God's will. And what we learned from last time, we looked at Noah, Abraham, Joseph, and we looked at the children of Israel last. And we started to see a couple things. First of all, we learned that God leads one step at a time. It's not often that He conveys to us His will all in advance, although occasionally He will do that. But God leads generally one step at a time. We also learned that there's a great discipline to the leadership of God. We learned that with the people of Israel. We saw how God led them to where there was no food. He led them where there was no water. And He told us specifically why He did that. He said, I led them to where there was no food so that they would learn that man does not live by bread alone. So much about God's leadership in your life and how God's will is going to be worked out in your life relates to God wanting you to learn complete dependence on Him. So the things that we may think we need, any of the crutches that we may tend to lean on, God removes those until all we have left is Him. And that's when we oftentimes discover that He is all we need. We also looked a little bit at Joseph, and we talked about the question of what happens when somebody else interferes in my life? Maybe they do something. Does that ruin God's will for my life? And we examined the life of Joseph and what his brothers did to him. And we learned basically that yes, other people can affect our lives by their sin, but that God is not taken by surprise. And He invariably works out His will for us through those circumstances so that His will is accomplished in spite of what others may do. Now we skipped over the life of Isaac from Genesis 24, and so tonight we're going to pick back up with Isaac. The story that's told to us in Genesis chapter 24 is kind of your ideal fairy story type narrative. And that is, here's Isaac, he is not married, and Abraham calls in a servant, makes him promise to go and get a wife for his son. The servant goes off. God miraculously leads. Servant comes back with this beautiful woman. They get married and live happily ever after. And of course, everybody reads this and thinks, oh, wouldn't that be wonderful if that's how God showed us His will for who He wants us to marry? And so I want to take a closer look at this particular story and maybe dig out some details about how God leads from this particular illustration. First of all, let's start with a little background. Abraham is, of course, a very rich and powerful person. How many have ever heard of Nick Saban? He is a very famous name here in the state of Alabama. Coach of the university's football program. He just won the national championship. He is wealthy. He is powerful in the sense that probably what he wants can be done. And he is well known. Abraham was exactly that kind of person. Very powerful, very wealthy. Here's a man who, when the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah went out to fight against some other kings that were arrayed against them, they lost the battle. Lot and his family were captured. Abraham was powerful enough to go off with his men, pursue them, attack them at night in a surprise attack, and take back everything that they had, defeat them and take back all the spoils. So he had powerful people that were indebted to him and who knew of him. And of course, Isaac was the eligible bachelor of the time. It would have been a huge deal who Isaac married. And you can be sure that the people and the lands and the various kingdom areas that were around there would have loved to marry into Abraham's family. That was what was done back then. It was a very big deal who you married off, and marriages created alliances and so on and so forth. And I'm sure, even though the text doesn't tell us, that many people in the surrounding area would have been offering Abraham and Isaac, if you're interested, consider my daughter, consider this woman. But What was Abraham's primary concern when it came to who Isaac was going to marry? He didn't want Isaac marrying from the pagan peoples that lived in that surrounding area. Remember that? He knew the promises of God, and he didn't want Isaac marrying into those people groups. He wanted Isaac to marry somebody back from where they had come from. Now, what that tells me right off the bat is that God honors those who are seeking to honor Him, right? And when we think about God leading our lives and directing us into His will, I think this story teaches us how important it is to be honoring God with what we're doing now. Are we following His commands? Are we putting Him first in our lives? Are we following all that we know to do? Is our testimony to those around us that here is a person who follows after God? Abraham certainly had that testimony in the area in which he lived. And people would have known. This time goes by, Isaac still doesn't take a wife. Everybody's wondering why. Word gets out. He doesn't want to marry these local peoples. It has to do with his God. Everybody had their own local deities. And of course, they would have respected Abraham's God. He had made him powerful and wealthy. And so it was a testimony to the surrounding peoples of the faithfulness and goodness of God. So Abraham wants to honor God. And if we expect God's leadership in our own lives, we need to make sure we're honoring Him as well. Now, Abraham brings in a servant, and he has him promise to go back to the land that they came from and pick out a wife. And Abraham makes a point of saying that God would send an angel before you. What does that tell us about Abraham's perspective on God's leadership in his life? Is God showing up late to the party? Certainly not. God actually is the one going ahead of us. And many times in our lives, as He leads us, we will look back and realize that God had gone before us and prepared the way. We didn't even realize it, perhaps. I find that to be very encouraging. And that's exactly in line with what we learn about Jesus Christ when He tells us in the Gospels, "I am the good shepherd and I lead my sheep." He doesn't drive the sheep, does He? He's not standing behind us, urging us to go forward. He is, in fact, walking on ahead of us. He's been there first before we ever get there. What an encouraging thought when we think about God's leadership. Now, you'll notice Eliezer sets off on his journey, and he takes the time to pray and ask Abraham's God for help. That tells me something about, right there, about how well Abraham had honored God in his own household. His servants, of course, believed in and respected Abraham's God. And I also think it speaks to us when we're setting out on a particular endeavor and we feel that this is the direction that God would have us to go. It's appropriate for us to take time to ask God for His guidance and His leadership. Eliezer took the time and said, "God, I'm about to make this search. I need Your help." We need God's guidance in our decision making. Now you might think, well, that just goes without saying it, doesn't it, Brother Brown? I mean, we just naturally would always ask God's guidance in our decision making. We're going to study a case tonight where that was not true. And you will discover there will be times in your life when you will think that you have all the information you need to make a wise decision, and you'll be dead wrong. But we'll look at that further when we come to Joshua. So Eliezer asks God for help, and God, of course, does that. But before we actually get into the details of how God answered his request, I want us to think about exactly what Eliezer asked for. So many times we think about this story and we think, oh, well, it was this miraculous thing. But when you think about Eliezer's request, what he was asking for was really not that miraculous. Eliezer's request from God spoke to the character of the person that he was looking for. You remember, he asked God, I'm gonna come up to the well and I'm gonna water my camels. and I'm going to ask one of the girls to water my camels. If she not only agrees to do that, but she waters my camel and agrees to water all the other camels, which would have been quite a task, then I'm going to know something about her character. What kind of a person is it who, when a stranger comes up and asks for help, not only is willing to help, but goes the extra mile? Was that really that miraculous of a request that he asked? No, not really. He was asking God to help understand and reveal the character of the person he was about to approach. So, what kind of person was Rebecca? Common courtesy alone would account for giving him a drink, but all the other camels being watered, that would indicate she was the kind of wife Abraham would want for his son. When we ask God for guidance, and occasionally there may be times in our walk with God that we ask Him for a sign. Okay? And we tend to think of these as open doors or closed doors. We're asking God to help us with circumstances that we may face. Many times you'll hear people want to do, well, I want to do the Gideon fleece kind of concept, where the request that I ask of God is some supernatural, bizarre thing that really doesn't relate to the situation at hand. But that's not what Eliezer did. I think Eliezer gives us a good example of the kinds of signs that we could request from God when we're seeking His will. He asked about the character of the person he was looking for. And so when we ask God for signs in our own lives, we should be asking God in these kinds of terms. Not going for the flashy supernatural sign, but going for a sign that will tell us something about the character of a person, the true nature of a situation, so on and so forth. And you'll notice that God was glorified by how He led Abraham's servant. And when we seek God's guidance, I feel like it should be with the thought in mind, God, I want You to be glorified in how You help me in this particular situation. The servant comes back with Rebecca, and everybody wants to know, how did you find this beautiful woman? She has great character. She agreed to come. She's agreeable to follow after Abraham's God. Where did you find this person? And so, of course, I can see Eliezer telling the story again and again, and the story spreads. It spreads throughout Abraham's camp, the city there probably, area where he was at, and then it spreads throughout the land. Isaac has a wife, and let me tell you how it happened. Abraham's God was the one who worked in the situation and brought this beautiful woman back to Isaac. God was glorified by what happened. Too often I feel like when we seek God's guidance, it's really all about us. And James warned us a little bit about that when he talked about you ask of God and receive not. Why? You asked only to consume it for yourself, and with no real sense of God gaining any glory. So I would urge us to consider, as we're making decisions and we're going in certain directions and we may be asking God to show us signs whether we should pursue different things, are we asking with the idea of God gaining the glory? And I feel like that is something that is very important that we can learn from the story of a wife for Isaac. Moving on, we're going to turn now to Exodus, and we're going to be looking at two situations from the life of Moses. Moses is a fascinating Old Testament character. He's kind of a romantic in my mind. He has a very colorful beginning story. He's born, they're going to kill him, they hide him in the basket, he's found by the princess. He grows up in Pharaoh's court. It's a very colorful story, one that children enjoy hearing. And he grows up, and in time, he identifies with the people of Israel. He comes to realize his own heritage. We find him out one day. He's looking at his people. They're enslaved. They're being beaten. And he comes upon an Egyptian beating a fellow Israelite. And what does he do? He looks this way, he looks that way, nobody's looking. He kills the Egyptian and buries him there in the sand. Well, the very next day, he realizes that his act has been discovered. And immediately he flees. Pharaoh, probably looking for the opportunity to kill him anyway, due to his ethnicity. Pharaoh was probably looking, just waiting until he did something to give him cause to get rid of this guy. Because in that situation, power was what was important, and Moses would have been a threat. So here was his opportunity. He pursues Moses. Moses flees off into the land of Midian. And what's the first thing we discover him doing out there? He stops at the well, and here are the seven daughters of a guy named Jethro. And they're there trying to water their father's flocks. And what happens? Other shepherds come up. There's only one well. They push the girls aside. And what does Moses do? He steps right in, and he comes to the rescue of the girls. So he's kind of a rooting for the underdog. He's willing to jump in and do things. And he ends up marrying one of the daughters of Jethro. And he lives out in the land of Midian for the next 40 years. He was 40 years when he fled. 40 years later, he's 80 years old. 40 years is a long time. Longer than I've been alive. And so the past with that murder that he committed and his people that are still in slavery, that's all probably faded into the background of his mind. And we find him out in Exodus chapter 3, pasturing the flock. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, which is the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire in the midst of a bush. And of course, we know the story. The bush is on fire, but it doesn't burn up. Take off your sandals. You're on holy ground. And the Lord begins to speak to Moses. Now, who wouldn't want God to come to you in the middle of your life and speak to you in a burning bush? How many would enjoy that experience? Absolutely. Wow. 40 years? I've settled down. I have a wife. I have children. And here God appears and he's speaking to me. And he begins to tell me that he wants me to be the one who goes back and rescues, leads the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And you notice that Moses begins to ask some questions. Now, I, of course, have often looked at this story and thought, if only God would speak as plainly to me as he did to Moses, how easy it would be to obey God. If he would just come and make himself plain, I would gladly do whatever he asked of me. Isn't that the thought? That's how we feel we would react. But as God talks to Moses, the first question Moses asks in verse 11, he says, "Who am I? Who am I that I should go and talk to Pharaoh? Why me? Why are you coming to me?" Now, when God leads, there may be times when he leads you in a direction and you think to yourself, that just doesn't seem like me. That just doesn't seem like the direction that would suit me. And what is God's response to the question of why me when Moses says that? Why should I be the one to go? What's God's response to that? I will be with you. So in the end, it's not really about Moses and his own innate ability to accomplish the task at hand. It's really much more about who is going with you. And folks, when we set out to follow God's will and we're being led by God, what matters most is not what we are capable of in and of ourselves. What matters most is who is going with us. I will go with you. So that's the end of it, right? Moses says, that's enough for me. If God is for me, who can be against me? Let's go! No, he has another question. Second question he has in verse 13. Well, look, if I go to the Israelites and I talk to them about some God sent me, there are lots of gods. Who am I going to say sent me? The Egyptians, of course, worshipped many different gods. And the plagues, as you've probably learned in Sunday school or Bible study, the plagues were often directly targeted at a particular god that the Egyptians worshipped. Who is it, shall I say, sent me? And God says, tell them I am who I am. And you'll tell them that I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is my name forever. I appeared to your forefathers, and I have seen your affliction in Egypt. I'm going to lead you up out of that land. I'm going to lead you to the land of the Canaanites. I'm going to give all that land to you. It is flowing with milk and honey. And in verse 18, he says, they will pay heed to what you say. And he tells them ahead of time. He actually, God, in a very rare case, God gives him details ahead of time of exactly what's going to happen. They will listen to you. You will go to Pharaoh. He will resist you. I will do this, and I will lead you out at the end. Man, God lays out His will and His... And there it is. What more do you need to know? Let's pack up and hit the road. That was enough for Moses, right? Well, I got one more question. And the third question he asked in chapter 4. What am I going to do when they don't believe me? Oh, wait a second. He said back in chapter 3, he says, they will pay heed to what you say, and they will come with you. Now, why is he saying now in chapter 4, verse 1, whoa, what if they won't believe me or they won't listen to what I say? How many detect some heels are being dug into the ground right about now? It's clear that Moses can see where this is heading, and his hopes of escaping God's will are disappearing. Isn't that interesting about the leadership of God? We tell ourselves that the more we know about what God has in store for us, the easier it would be to obey. And what this teaches us is exactly the opposite. Advanced knowledge of your future does not make it easier to follow God. Now that to me is a fascinating discovery. Because intuitively I would think it would be exactly the opposite. The more I knew, the easier it gets. And in fact, that's not true at all. Now I think God might have been a little annoyed with Moses right here. What do I do if they don't believe me? I've just told you that they will. But God says, all right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you three signs. First of all, take your staff, throw it to the ground, and what happens to it? It becomes a serpent. Scared Moses to death. He runs off. God tells him, come back, pick it up by the tail. How many think it's a good idea to pick up a snake by the tail? That is not what you do. Turns back into a staff. Put your hand inside your coat. Leprosy. And God says even further, if after those two signs you still have difficulty, go and get some of the water from the Nile and pour it out and it will become blood. How could you not just be ready to follow God's leadership in your life? He's given you exactly what's going to happen. He's told you He would go with you. He's given you miraculous signs. It's happened right in front of your eyes. Your faith is built. And what does Moses do? Oh, what about my speech? I'm not good at speaking. I'm not good talking. It just won't work. I can't do this. God said, who made your mouth? What I learned from this is, when God leads us into an area of ministry, or perhaps even a job, or a relationship, and we feel like we're not equipped to do the job at hand, we need to keep in mind that God is able to give us the skills and the abilities to accomplish what He has in store for us to do. Who made your mouth? Cannot the one who made your mouth also enable you to speak? Wow. You know, you're right, God. Now that I think about it, I'm ready to go. Is that what Moses said? No, after all of that, Moses said, oh, please, just send somebody else. Send somebody else. And that's when God got angry. Okay? It says, then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. Again, we're talking about how God leads. If only God would be more specific with what He wants. If only God would reveal more to me. If only I wasn't wandering around in the dark, feeling helpless. I would gladly do whatever He says. But has He ever asked you to go in a certain direction? You felt like, well, I'm not good at that. I can't do that. Well, I'm afraid of going that direction. I'll be all alone. Who's going with you? Who can give you the ability to do what God wants you to do? And a last closing, kind of fascinating look at God's leadership is, was God taken by surprise at Moses' reaction? No. And He said, is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he speaks fluently, and moreover, he is coming to meet you. God knew already that Moses was going to dig in his heels, and He had sent Aaron on ahead before he ever even appeared in the burning bush. That's kind of sad in a way. God tried to lead Moses, and in spite of all of these signs, and in spite of all the clearness of making His will known, Moses still resisted, and God had to send his brother. And Moses and Aaron then went. I hope that's not going to be true of us in God's leadership of our lives. The second illustration of God's leadership in the life of Moses, Exodus chapter 18, we find the Israelites, they have been led out of Egypt into the wilderness, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had heard everything that happened. Pharaoh's army being destroyed, the plagues, this had spread all over the Middle East. And he came out to see Moses, and he brought with him Moses' wife, Zipporah, and the two sons. And Jethro comes in, and Moses goes out to greet him, and he invites him into the tent, and they sit down, and Moses is discussing all that God has done for the people of Israel. And he tells Jethro the exciting stories of the Red Sea, and how God provided water, and so on and so forth. And Jethro is, of course, excited, and he worships God, offers sacrifices. And the next day, Moses went out, it says in verse 13, to judge the people. And the people stood around Moses from morning until evening. And Jethro goes out, and he's observing what's happening, and he notices how Moses is surrounded by all these people. And he says, what are you doing? This doesn't make sense. He says, I have a suggestion for you. The people that are coming to inquire about God to you, why don't you're going to wear yourself out? He says, you will surely wear out both yourself and the people that are with you. This task is too heavy for you. You can't do it alone. Listen to me. I will give you counsel. God will be with you. You select out able men who fear God, and you'll put these over hundreds, over thousands, tens. And he helps Moses split out the responsibility of dealing with the tremendous amount of people that he was dealing with. Now you notice that God did not come to Moses in a burning bush or in some supernatural way and say, Moses, what you're trying to do is good, but you're going about it the wrong way. What does he do instead? He sends along Jethro of all people. Many times it will be that God will lead us by the counsel of another person. Again, we're thinking about finding God's will, right? Now, it doesn't always have to be a Christian or somebody who's walked with God for a long time. Normally we think, well, I only want counsel from somebody who's been walking with God a long time. They're the only ones I really trust. No, that's not always true. Sometimes God can lead us through the counsel of somebody who is maybe worldly wise. But Jethro's suggestion was a good one. Doesn't mean that you necessarily seek out non-Christian counsel, but it also means that you shouldn't ignore it completely. You should take that into account, because God does sometimes lead us through the advice of these kinds of people. And of course, He also does lead us through the counsel of godly leaders, friends in our life, so on and so forth. So I just call that little example to mind. God oftentimes leads us through the counsel of other people.